sometimes it can be tough to not feel important. Like Pastor Ben said, my name is Nick. I'm one of the pastors here at Timberlake. By the way, just sort of to clear the air here from the get-go, if you're wondering why, I'm doing hand puppet motions. Actually, Pastor Ben asked me earlier in the week, we knew it was going to be in the 70s. He said, hey, Nick, would you mind teaching? And I tried to tell him no, so he wanted to arm wrestle. And I let him win. No, just kidding. That didn't happen. But I broke my hand playing basketball a few weeks ago. Minor Uncle Rico moment setback, but it's healing and all that. Like Pastor Ben also said, we're continuing our series, Plan B, Surviving Life Setbacks, here this weekend. We're talking about the idea, just to kind of give us a guide and a course of where we're heading this morning. We're talking about the idea of greatness redefined. That's the title. It's at the top of your outline. And we're going to be talking about what greatness and success and achievement and all these things look like in our lives and in God's kingdom and all that. And so to help us understand it a little better this morning, I brought a friend along with me. It's a rooster. There he is. I don't think he has a name. I think someone said his name was Mr. Rooster. I have to give a shout out to one of our high school student leaders, Jessie. She hooked up the rooster for us. It's actually a carnation rooster. It's definitely not used to seeing this many people in one place. And try not to use too many big words or anything like that. No, just kidding. I was doing some research this week about roosters and chickens and all that kind of thing. And does anyone know, you can shout out, does anyone know how a chicken's social structure is organized, what that's called? Does anyone know? Pecking order. Yeah, a few people said it. Very good. And here's how the pecking order works, that if you're able to peck other chickens, talk bad about them with other chickens, rip their feathers out, intimidate them, you are able to move up in the pecking order. It's really similar, if you've ever seen the show Real Housewives of Orange County, very similar to that, and you're able to move up on the, and so here's what the pecking order means is, it just clucked. Here's what the pecking order means is if you're high up on the pecking order, you have access to all the food you want. You get the prime real estate in the chicken coop. You don't have to worry about anything. You're totally safe. You're protected because you're high on the pecking order. And on the flip side of that, if you're low on the pecking order, you always have to watch your back. Other chickens are always trying to sneak up on you, rip out your feathers, intimidate you. You have to be really careful on where you live and all that kind of thing. And it's really interesting. Farmers, this is a big problem for people who raise chickens, is because chickens can actually die in moving up or down on the pecking order. So throughout the years, they've tried to develop ways to subvert the pecking order. I believe it or not, I did some chicken research this week, and you wonder what pastors do all week. I researched chickens, and I found out some really interesting stuff. There's actually a product that's called Peck No More. And this is a true story. It's a solution that you can put on chickens that'll make them taste bad to one another. But the truth is they still end up pecking each other. And then several years ago, a farmer in the Midwest developed contact lenses for chickens. You could put on the chickens' eyes, and it would make make their vision blurry, and they wouldn't see other chickens quite as well. Turned out to be a problem, though, because they're chickens, they didn't wash out their contact lenses, ever. And so the contact lens would, fuse to the chicken's eye, and they ended up going blind. And there's also red goggles you can put over chickens. It'll make everything, appear red to them. And so red makes chickens aggressive. And so there's been all this research, all these efforts to really turn the pecking order upside down. Because here's what's really interesting about the pecking order is that a chicken's whole world, their entire existence, hinges completely on the pecking order, where they're able to live, who they're able to hang out with, where the amount of food they get. It's all about where they're at on the pecking order. Interesting. And so this morning, I'm sure you've guessed by now, we're not talking about chickens. In fact, they're gonna remove the chicken now. They're just gonna pull it off. By the way, if you're worried about it, the chicken's not gonna be harmed. This is a Whole Foods chicken. It's gonna get a massage and a manicure, and no, the chicken is gonna be just fine. But what I want to do is, in fact, if you take your outline out of your program, there's a story at the top, and it's a story where Jesus is interacting with some of his disciples. And this question about greatness, about the pecking order, comes up. Let's read it together. I'll read, and then you can just follow along. Here's what it says. Then the mother of James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to Jesus with her sons. She knelt respectfully to ask a favor. What is your request? He asked. She replied, in your kingdom, please let my two sons sit in places of honor next to you, one on your right and the other on your left. When the 10 other disciples heard what James and John had asked, they were indignant. But Jesus called them together and said, "You know that the rulers in this world lord it over their people, and officials flaunt their authority over those under them." And will you do this? Will you underline this next part, just this next sentence? "But among you, it will be different. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first among you must become your slave. For even the Son of Man," that's Jesus, "came not to be served, but to serve others, and to give his life as a ransom for many." And for just a couple moments, let me give us some context in this passage to kind of help us understand a little bit better what's going on here. As Jesus is talking to 12 of his friends. Historically, you know, biblical historians, theologians, they've agreed that, you know, Jesus probably had large crowds following him around wherever he went. That's why wherever Jesus goes in his teaching, it says that there was a multitude around. But Jesus has his inner circle, 12 very close friends. And this question, even amongst them, this question of being great amongst their friends comes up. And Jesus, and it's really interesting though, Jesus is speaking to a group of people who live in the first century in the Roman-occupied state of Palestine. And what's interesting, not to give us too much of a history lesson, but what's really interesting just about Roman society, Roman culture, is it's all built around status. It's all built around where your place was in life. In fact, Cicero, the Roman statesman and philosopher, here's what he says about it, that rank must be preserved. You know, he basically goes on to assert the idea that the strength of Rome, the backbone of what makes Rome a great society and a great nation, is their understanding of social class. In fact, in Rome, you were able to dress a certain way, live in certain places, hang out with certain people. Even the people you were able to talk to or interrupt in speech was all based around, structured around where you fell on the social strata, where you fell on the pecking order. And it's really interesting. Jesus is saying this to a group of people who are very familiar with this concept. That's why he says, you know that the officials, you know that the rulers in this world lord it over their people, and officials flaunt their authority over those under them. And when Jesus says that, the people that are listening are very familiar with that. Absolutely. They live in a society, in an area where people would buy expensive garments they couldn't afford with labels on them. They would drive chariots that were way out of their price range just so they could have a place in social, have a certain social status. Weird concept. But I think even a few levels up from that, Jesus is really, he's well aware. See, he's well aware of just the human propensity to have a desire to escalate ourselves in life, to move up. Now listen, you're probably here and you're thinking, you know, Nick, to be honest with you, you've kind of been following along and you're thinking, well, isn't this a good thing? You know, isn't it good to desire to be great, to desire to move up in the world? And the answer is absolutely yes. We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. But, you know, I think what Jesus is saying here, he's proposing the idea that ends up, it's really a pretty radical idea, that maybe he's saying there's a better way to live your life. In fact, if you're here and you're not a follower of Jesus Christ, you're just checking us out this weekend, would you maybe be open to this idea? That maybe you don't agree with everything I'm going to say, but maybe you'd agree with the idea that perhaps what Jesus is describing here, even though it doesn't seem normal, it doesn't seem like our natural propensity, maybe what he's describing here is another, a different and a better way to live. So if you're following along in the outline, let's start with three problems with the pecking order. Here's the first one, is it emphasizes status over service. You know, I think in the same way that it's a natural inclination for us to have a desire to move up in society, to move up, to have a higher position and a higher status, it's an equally unnatural inclination for us to have a desire to serve other people. And I probably noticed this most when I got married. I've been married for just about a year now, closing a couple weeks away from 1 year. I already know what you're thinking. You know, Nick, are you going to write a book? Yes, soon. Just kidding. But I noticed this when we first got married, in the first few months of being married, I noticed that my wife and I have different standards, especially when it comes to cleanliness and cleaning. Have you noticed that? For instance, when I go to clean, say I'm going to clean the kitchen. When I go to clean the kitchen, what I normally do is I'll gather the dishes that are in the sink, maybe give them a quick rinse, probably not, and throw them in the dishwasher. What I also do is if I'm putting bread away, say there's a loaf of bread, I do what virtually I'm assuming every guy in here does. I grab the bread, spin it, and fold the flap under. You know, I don't use like, you know, the bread clasp, but you know, my life would probably be better if I did. But when my wife does the dishes, she'll like go through and she'll hand wash every dish really carefully. She'll make sure it feels good. She'll like, you know, rub it and make sure it's clean. And then she'll put it in the dishwasher. And you know, it ends up not being that big of a deal except for when, you know, we'll go to take a dish out and there's like a little bit of residue on it. And she'll say, "Did you wash these before you put them in there?" You know, and I'll be like, "Yeah, of course. You know, I always do." And I'm like, "What's the big deal? You know, there's a little food on there, but it's clean food. You know, it's at least it's been through the dishwasher." And it ends up not being, you know, that big of a deal. But, you know, I think what's really interesting is when we think of service, you know, when like in that story, when Jesus says, if you want to be great, you got to serve. When we think of service, oftentimes we think about it like doing these big, elaborate service projects. And those are really good things. You know, we have a growth group. In fact, here at Timberlake, it's one of the largest groups, and it's people who get together and they serve, and that's awesome. But do you know what I think Jesus is describing here? Is he's saying, do you know what real service is about? Sometimes it's just about plates and glasses. You know, sometimes it's just about the little things day in and day out that make you more and more like him. So maybe what Jesus would say is, if you're having a hard time with this, if you're having a hard time with understanding greatness and what that's about, maybe, you know, in your marriage, serve. With your kids, serve. With your friends, serve. With your coworkers, serve. Even with people who you know you deserve to be promoted over, serve. And, you know, oftentimes it's these small opportunities that we take small steps toward becoming more and more and more like Jesus Christ. You know, Pastor Ben alluded to it. By the way, if it's your first time here this weekend, come back another weekend, really. Pastor Ben's a much better speaker than me, and he paid me a really small amount to say that. No, just kidding. But, you know, he alluded to it in his prayer this morning that oftentimes, see, what we think about the Christian walk as what we can get from God sometimes. You know, we think about it as, can God improve my relationships? Can God improve my marriage? Can God improve my friendships? And you know, really the message of Jesus Christ isn't about that. See, it's about becoming more and more like him. Well, that leads to the second thing is it seeks accolades over achievement. You know, I'm not really into reading, you know, a ton into these ideas, but there's been a lot of research that goes into what categorizes different generations. You know, the social events that happen that make up the people that live in a demographic bubble. And so there's, you know, the greatest generation, the boomer generation. My generation is the millennial generation, people born between 1985 and 2000. And another name for the millennial generation, do you know what it is the trophy generation. Because people, and it's true growing up, that you received a trophy for everything you did. I know this is true because when I was a little kid, I was on a swim team, and I remember one time I got an 8th place ribbon, and there were 8 lanes to the pool. And so, you know, that would have been better off getting like a swim lesson instead of an 8th place voucher for last. So, and it's really interesting though. So I think this idea kind of permeates into sometimes the way we think about faith. You know, it's the idea that, well, if I'm not going to receive recognition for this, if I'm not going to get the credit, then why would I do it? And the whole focus is not necessarily on what you're trying to accomplish, whether in your faith or in serving someone else. It's what you're going to get credit for. It's like, well, I don't necessarily know if I want to serve because I want to at least, you know, get some kudos for it. I want someone to recognize that I'm working really hard here. And that leads to the third thing, which is probably the biggest problem with the pecking order, is it misinterprets success. You know, another way to say, you know, the pecking order would just be the natural way that we understand greatness, that we understand success. And what's the whole point of rising to the top? What's the point of getting to the top of the pecking order? Is you get to peck, right? The whole point of getting to the top is you get to say, I've arrived. You get to peck on other people. You get to make them feel good or feel bad about themselves. In a word, you've achieved control. You've achieved control over not only your life, but those around you. Isn't that the point of rising to the top of the pecking order? If you're a chicken, that's the whole point, is you get to peck on other chickens. And you know what I think the biggest, maybe the biggest problem, though, with our natural way of understanding success and greatness and all these things is our entire purpose in life focuses on rising to the top, being successful. And it's a misconception because we equate those things with being great. And so for the rest of our time this morning, what I want to do is look at three truths, and I know there's definitely way more than three, but three truths about what Jesus says greatness is about in his kingdom. Here's the first one, is Jesus does not rebuke greatness. He redefines it. And I think, you know, as we talk about what greatness is like in God's kingdom, this is a really important place to start. Because see, sometimes there's the idea that in order to be great in God's kingdom, you know, when if you're thinking, well, in order to be great in God's kingdom, do I need to give up, you know, all my possessions, all my status, all these things? Should I not have a desire to be great? And that would be a misinterpretation of what Jesus is saying. In fact, what Jesus says, if you notice in that passage when his disciples say, we want to be great, you know what he doesn't do? He doesn't say, don't be great. In fact, he says, be great. You should be great. There's a verse in your outline, Colossians 3:23. It says, whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord. And I think that it's a misconception. It's an interesting conversation, especially in some Christian circles, that there's the idea that if I really want to be great for God, if I want to do great things for God, well, then I can't have position, I can't have status, I can't have any of these things. And that's not what Jesus says. Rather, what Jesus says is, let me help you, let me reinterpret what that's going to look like in your life. In fact, some of the most, the people I know that are most like Jesus Christ, oftentimes, are the most successful in a lot of ways. But I think what they've learned, they figured out, is that it's not about desiring to achieve the status and the greatness. It's instead, they've taken on what Jesus says, this is what greatness looks like. You know, there's a verse in your outline, and it's a really interesting verse. Let me just read it for you, and then we'll talk about it. Matthew 25:23 says, his master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. And this verse comes, Jesus tells a story to some of the people around him, and he says, three guys were given three different talents, and a talent was equated with money. And three guys are given three different sums of money, one was given two, and one was given five. And do you know who this verse that Jesus says, well done, you did a good job, it's in response to, he's talking to the person who's been given the most. So the idea that you can't be successful, that you can't achieve status and position and be like Jesus, would just be a really bad way to understand what the Bible's saying. In fact, it's not about that. See, Jesus, what he says, it's not about not being successful or being successful. What Jesus, rather, he's saying is, here's what it really means to be great. And so that's a great place to start. Here's the second one, is that there is always a cost involved. You know, this week I was having a conversation with a friend, and he said something that I thought was really, really profound. You know, he said, you know, if you want to do something great in God's kingdom, there's always going to be a cost. And I thought about that, and I thought, man, that, you know, I never had realized that before. And then he went on to say, sometimes you expect other people to pay your cost, even though you want to do something great for God. See, just because God calls you to something doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be easy. In fact, I'm going to go so far to say this morning, someone in some way has paid a cost for you to be here. Maybe when you were growing up, it was a parent or a grandparent who prayed tirelessly for you. Maybe it was a Sunday school teacher who gave up time on their weekend every weekend to teach you about Jesus Christ. Maybe, and I'm biased here, maybe it was a youth leader who came alongside you at a really difficult and confusing point in your life and said, I'm going to walk with you. By the way, I'm just going to, if it's okay, I guess it's okay, I'm going to brag on our youth leaders. You know, we have people here at Timberlake Church in our student ministry who work 10 and 12 hour days. They don't even have kids in the program. And you know what they do after work is they drive straight to a Chipotle or a Starbucks or open up their home and they have students over. And they'll walk with them, and they'll invest in them, and they text them during the week, and they're involved in their lives, and they go to their games, and they do all these things. You know why? It's because at some point along the way, they've recognized this, and someone paid the cost for me. And in your walk with Jesus Christ, you know what a really good mark of maturity is? Not the only one, but definitely a milestone, a milepost you can look at and say, I'm becoming more mature, is when you've recognized that there's been a cost paid for you and that you're willing to pay the cost for someone else. And you know, maybe it wasn't even that long ago. Maybe you're here this weekend and this is a new idea to you that someone paid a cost. But listen, even really recently, maybe someone took a chance, paid a cost. They said, I'm willing to look silly, to look foolish to you, but I want to invite you to church. Man, I want you to come check out Timberlake this Easter. Or I want you to come check out Timberlake this weekend. Maybe you're here and someone did that for you. And so regardless of where you're at, you know, on the spectrum, here's my question. If you'd be honest enough with yourself, here's my question is, am I at a place where I'd be willing to pay the cost for someone else? Just like someone paid the cost for you, would you say, yeah, I'm willing to pay the price, to pay the cost for God to do something great in this person's life? And, you know, one of the perks of not having children yet, my wife and I don't have any kids, one of the perks, and I'm sure there are many, is we get to watch a lot of late night TV. And one of my favorite things to watch is infomercials. I don't know if anybody else loves infomercials. I get just a big kick out of them. They're always, you know, the people who are in trouble are always in black and white, and it's in color when there's, you know, like some device. And do you, this is already a few years old, but does anyone know what this is? A Snuggie, yes. And by the way, if you do this with your family, you should probably go into counseling right now, because look at this, the dog even has a Snuggie. But it's, you know, actually my wife owns a Snuggie. It's a big, you know, point of conflict in our marriage. But here's the whole point of the Snuggie. If you're watching the commercial, you know, the guy, the voiceover comes in, he's like, have you ever been wrapped up so tightly in a blanket and you wanted to change the channel? And, you know, it shows the person like struggling in the blanket like a cocoon, and they try and get their arm out. I'm thinking, you know, really? You know, that's not a problem I have very often. But here's the whole idea of the Snuggie is this, is you don't have to sacrifice any of your own comfort when you're in the Snuggie. If you want to change the channel, if you want to grab a chip, if you, you know, want to scratch your dog or something, you don't have to get out of the Snuggie at all. And sometimes this, we can begin to have a Snuggie theology. We can begin to have the idea that life with Jesus Christ is simply about comfort. And I want to be careful here, because life with Jesus Christ, God is absolutely concerned with your daily life, with your relationships, with your marriages, with your friendships. God is concerned with all those things. But we would do you a really big disservice as a church. Listen, we would be remiss if we just simply told you that life with Jesus was all about your comfort. In fact, you know, what Jesus says is life with me is not about comfort. It's about the cross. You know, here's what Jesus invites us to, is not to come and be comfortable. It's to come and die. It's to come and leave the life that we've envisioned, the greatness that we hope to achieve, the status that we hope to achieve, and take on what he has for us. There's this verse in your outline. Here's what it says. It says, whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. And so that's where there's a cost involved. If you want to be great in God's kingdom, if you want to do something great for God, if you want to say, Jesus, I want to take on what you say about greatness and this idea of what it means to be great for you, is there a cost? Absolutely. And did someone pay that cost for you at some point along the way? Yeah, but do you know what? I think, you know, what Jesus invites us to is to a fuller life, is to a better way to live, which leads us to our third thing, is it always begins with trust. I think I've talked about it here before. When I was growing up, you know, I'm half Korean, my mom's Korean, and so it was pretty strict and disciplined, especially when it came to my academic success. She was really committed to that. In fact, this was a joke. Like, do you know what an Asian B+ is called? It's called you're grounded. And so that was sort of, you know, my life growing up. I was really limited in the amount of TV I could watch, and I couldn't really play video games or anything like that. But I was able to have one movie. I had one, you know, movie that I hung on to, and I watch it 3 or 4 times a week. It's the movie Aladdin. I don't know if you've seen. It's a cinematic masterpiece by Disney, and I would always watch. You know, I'd memorize. I had the genie lines memorized. I could even do the monkey voiceovers. I could do all of it. And there's this scene though in the movie Aladdin. I don't know if you've seen it, where Aladdin comes up to Jasmine, and she's on the terrace, and he comes riding a magic carpet, you know, just go with it, and he comes up to her, and he extends his hand. It's this, it's the crux of the movie, the turning point, where he reaches out his hand to her, and he says, "Do you trust me?" And of course, at that point, she thinks back to the time that there, you know, Aladdin is now a prince. Before that, though, before he met the genie, he was just a street thief, but at one point, him and Jasmine met. And he extended her hand to her, and, you know, she makes the connection in her mind, "Do you trust me?" And do you know what I think, though? One of the biggest challenges, if I'm really honest with you this morning, one of the biggest challenges about this whole concept of greatness in God's kingdom and allowing God to redefine it for us and all these things, one of the hardest things for me personally is, what if it doesn't work out? You know, what if I decide to say, okay, you know, I'm going to trust you. I'm going to take on what you say about greatness. I'm not going to be self-serving. I'm not going to try to get ahead for me. I'm going to take what you say seriously. But what if it doesn't work out? I don't know if you've wondered about that. I think about it a lot. And really the question behind the question there is, would I still trust God? Maybe for some of you, I know these are very real things. Maybe you've been hurt and you're thinking, well, if I forgive again, will it be worth it? You know, if I trust again, will it be worth it? If I choose to believe again, what if something like this happens? And you know, to be really, really honest, I don't have an answer. I don't know. You know, I don't know what's going to happen. But here's what I do know, is that it can only start when you're willing to take a first step forward and trust God. Someone describes trust as coming to the edge of what you can see and trusting God for the rest. And so there's this story in your outline, and this we'll start to wrap up here. And it's one of my favorite stories in the Bible. It's really interesting. Let me just let you know what's going on so you're not confused when we jump into it. This is in the Old Testament, and the prophet Elijah, he's one of Israel's greatest prophets. At this time in Israel's history, they've turned their back on God. They're following what the Bible calls other masters, and they're following these things, and they've basically rejected God. And Elijah comes, and he says, "Listen, let's have a contest. Let's see who the real God is." So what Elijah proposes to these other prophets is, he says, "Let's build an altar. We'll put a sacrifice on it. And whichever God sends fire down, he is the true God." And so they go into it, and these other prophets go, and they're dancing all day, and they're doing all these things, and nothing happens. And then check, here's how the story picks up. So there's Elijah. It says, "He arranged the wood, cut the bull into pieces, and laid it on the wood. Then he said to them, 'Fill 4 large jars with water and pour it on the offering and on the wood.'" And I just want to pause there, because there's something that's really interesting that's happening in this story. Is at this time, also in Israel's history, because they've turned their back on God, God has caused it to stop raining for 3 years. It hasn't rained. There's no water. Because there's no water, there's a famine. There's no irrigation. There's no crops or animals or anything like that. Their whole sense of economy has been stopped. And so when Elijah says, "Pour water on this," this is a crazy idea. You know, the people there probably think, "Elijah, we don't have water. We don't have very much water to offer." But nonetheless, he says, "Pour 4 large jars of water on it." And then it's interesting. He says, "Do it again," he said. And they did it again. "Do it a third time," he ordered. And they did it a third time. And not that I'm really into, you know, I think you can get really wacky with Bible numerology, but there's something interesting going on. Is, you know, 4 times 3 is 12. And anytime you see 12 in the Bible, here's what it signifies. It signifies that something is complete. You know, there's 12 tribes of Israel. There's 12 disciples of Jesus. It's this number in the Bible that usually signifies something is complete. And so what I think Elijah's doing, he's saying, in the fullest sense, God, in the most complete sense, "I trust you." You know, so the people around him have to be thinking, "This guy has lost it. We don't have any water. What's he doing?" And he says, "No, pour the water on. Do it again." Psh, they pour the water on again. And do it a third time. By the third time, they're probably thinking, "This is nuts. What's Elijah doing?" But Elijah's saying, "God, you know, if this is going to work out, I'm completely trusting you. You're going to have to make this happen." So for you this morning, here's all I would ask, is that you just be really honest with yourself. You know, you'd say this morning, how am I doing with trusting God? If you're not all the way there, if you're not saying I completely trust God, that's totally fine. But maybe this morning what you do is, I want to take a step forward in that. God, I want to take a step forward towards you, towards understanding your definition of success. I want your definition of what it means to be successful, what it means to be great, to begin to define my life. Will you pray with me? Father, this morning, God, Lord, we come to you and we bring you all of our doubts, all of our questions, everything we have a hard time understanding. And God, we just lay them at your feet. And God, I pray for all of us here this morning, myself included, God, who this is a challenge for, who this idea of greatness in your kingdom, this idea of putting aside what we want, what our greatest ambitions are, putting them aside and taking on yours, God, this is a challenge for them and for us. And Lord, I pray this morning, especially for those of us who would say, God, I want to trust you, but I'm just not sure if it's going to work out. You know, what if it doesn't work out? What if I get hurt again? What if I lose everything? Lord, I don't know exactly how you do it, but I pray that you would give them your assurance now. God, that you would show all of us that you're trustworthy. And God, that we would begin to adopt into our lives, into our families, into our careers, your definition of greatness. God, your definition of success. God, that we would look for the opportunities to serve. We would look for the opportunities to give and to pay the cost for others, not for the recognition we get, not for the status we get, not for any of those things, but simply to become more and more like you. Lord, and in that, I do ask, God, that you would make all of us great in your kingdom, that you would make us great for you. We love you so much this morning, and it's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen.